better you than me, he said, and placing his knee firmly in the man's midriff, sloshed the contents of the flask over the exposed tissues. A dreadful roar shook the walls, and Macbeth writhed like a cut snake. When the noise at last subsided, his face had gone a mottled greenish colour, and he made no objection at all as I began the routine, if painful, job of stitching up the scrotum. Most of the patients, even those horribly wounded, were stoic about the primitive treatment to which we subjected them, and Macbeth was no exception. He lay unmoving in hideous embarrassment, eyes fixed on the lantern flame, and didn't move a muscle as I made my repairs. Only the changing colours of his face, from green to white to red, and back again, betrayed his emotions. At the last, however, he went purple. As I finished the stitching, the limp penis began to stiffen slightly, brushed in passing by my hand. Thoroughly rattled by this justification of his faith in Jamie's word, Macbeth snatched down his kilt the instant I was finished, lurched to his feet, and staggered away into the darkness, leaving me giggling over my kit. I found a corner where a chest of medical supplies made a seat, and leaned against the wall. A surge of pain shot up my calves, the sudden release of tension and the nerves' reaction to it. I slipped off my shoes and leaned back against the wall, revelling in the smaller spasms that shot up backbone and neck as the strain of standing was relieved. Every square inch of skin seems newly sensitive in such a state of fatigue, when the necessity of forcing the body to perform is suddenly suspended. The lingering impetus seems to force the blood to the perimeter of the body, as though the nervous system is reluctant to believe what the muscles have already gratefully accepted. You needn't move just now. The air in the cottage was warm and noisy with breathing. Not the healthy racket of snoring men, but the shallow gasps of men for whom breathing hurts, and the moans of those who have found a temporary oblivion that frees them from the manly obligation of suffering in silence. The men in this cottage were those badly wounded, but in no immediate danger. I knew, though, that death walks at night in the aisles of a sick ward, searching for those whose defences are lowered, who may stray unwittingly into its path through loneliness and fear. Some of the wounded had wives who slept next to them to comfort them in the dark, but none in this cottage. They had me. If I could do little to heal them or stop their pain, I could at least let them know that they didn't lie alone, that someone stood here between them and the shadow. Beyond anything I could do, it was my job only to be there. I rose and made my way slowly once again through the pallets on the floor, stooping at each one, murmuring and touching, straightening a blanket, smoothing tangled hair, rubbing the knots that formed in cramped limbs. A sip of water here, a change of dressing there. The reading of an attitude of tense embarrassment that meant a urinal was needed, and the matter-of-fact presentation that allowed the man to ease himself, the stone bottle growing warm and heavy in my hand. I stepped outdoors to empty one of these, and paused for a moment, gathering the cool, rainy night to myself, letting the soft moisture wipe away the touch of coarse, hairy skin and the smell of sweating men.
"You dinna sleep much, Sassenach?"
The soft Scottish voice came from the direction of the road. The other hospital cottages lay in that direction, the officer's quarters the other way, in the village manse.
"You didn't sleep much either," I responded dryly.
How long had he gone without sleep, I wondered.
"I slept in the fields last night, with the men."
"Oh, yes."
"Very restful," I said,
with an edge that made him laugh. 6 hours' sleep in a wet field, followed by a battle in which he'd been stepped on by a horse, wounded by a sword, and done God knows what else. Then he had gathered his men, collected the wounded, tended the hurt, mourned his dead, and served his prince. And through none of it had I seen him pause for food, drink, or rest. I didn't bother scolding. It wasn't even worth mentioning that he ought to have been among the patients on the floor.
It was his job to be here as well. There are other women, Sassenach, he said gently. Shall I have Archie Cameron send someone down? It was a temptation, but one I pushed away before I could think about it too long, for fear that if I acknowledged my fatigue, I would never move again. I stretched, hands against the small of my back. No, I said. I'll manage till the dawn. Then someone else can take over for a time. Somehow I felt that I must get them through the night. At dawn they would be safe. He didn't scold either, just laid a hand on my shoulder and drew me to lean against him for a moment. We shared what strength we had, unspeaking.
I'll stay with you then, he said, drawing away at last. I canna sleep before light myself.
The other men from Lallybroch? He moved his head toward the fields near the town where the army was camped.
Murtaugh's in charge.
Oh, well then, nothing to worry about, I said, and saw him smile in the light from the window. There was a bench outside the cottage where the goodwife would sit on sunny days to clean fish or mend clothes. I drew him down to sit beside me, and he sagged back against the wall of the house with a sigh. His patent exhaustion reminded me of Fergus and the boy's expression of confused bewilderment after the battle. I reached to caress the back of Jamie's neck, and he turned his head blindly toward me, resting his brow against my own.
"How was it, Jamie?"
I asked softly, fingers rubbing hard and slow over the tight-ridged muscles of his neck and shoulders. "What was it like? Tell me." There was a short silence. Then he sighed and began to talk, haltingly at first, and then faster, as if wanting to get it out.
"We had no fire, for Lord George thought we must move off the ridge before daylight, and wanted no hint of movement to be seen below. We sat in the dark for a time. Couldn't even talk, for the sound would carry to the plain. So we sat. Then I felt something grab my thigh in the dark and near jumped out of my skin."
He inserted a finger in his mouth and rubbed gingerly.
"Nearly bit my tongue off."
I felt the shift of his muscles as he smiled, though his face was hidden.
"Fergus?"
The ghost of a laugh floated through the dark.
"Aye, Fergus. Crawled through the grass on his belly, the little bastard, and I thought he was a sneak at that. He whispered to me about Anderson, and I crawled off after him and took Anderson to see Lord George."
His voice was slow and dreamy, talking under the spell of my touch.
"And then the order came that we'd move, following Anderson's trail, and the whole of the army got to its feet and set off in the dark."
The night was clear black and moonless, without the usual cover of cloud that trapped starlight and diffused it toward the earth. As the Highland army made its way in silence down the narrow path behind Richard Anderson, each man could see no farther than the shuffling heels of the man before him, each step widening the trodden path through wet grass. The army moved almost without noise. Orders were relayed in murmurs from man to man, not shouted. Broadswords and axes were muffled in the folds of their plaids, powder flasks tucked inside shirts against fast-beating hearts. Once on sound footing, still in total silence, the Highlanders sat down, made themselves as comfortable as was possible without fire, ate what cold rations there were, and composed themselves to rest, wrapped in their plaids, in sight of the enemy's campfires.
"We could hear them talking," Jamie said.
His eyes were closed, hands clasped behind his head as he leaned against the cottage wall.
"Odd to hear men laughing over a jest, or asking for a pinch of salt or a turn at the wineskin, and know that in a few hours ye may kill them, or them you. Ye can't help wondering, ye ken, what does the face behind that voice look like? Will ye know the fellow if ye meet him in the morning?"
Still, the tremors of anticipated battle were no match for sheer fatigue, and the Black Frasers, so called for the traces of charcoal that still adorned their features, and their chief had been awake for more than 36 hours by then.
He had picked a sheaf of marrow grass for a pillow, tucked the plaid around his shoulders, and lain down in the waving grass beside his men. During his time with the French army, years before, one of the sergeants had explained to the younger mercenaries the trick of falling asleep the night before a battle.
"Make yourself comfortable, examine your conscience, and make a good act of contrition. Father Hugo says that in time of war, even if there is no priest to shrive you, your sins can be forgiven this way. Since you cannot commit sins while asleep, not even you, Simonon, you will awake in a state of grace, ready to fall on the bastards. And with nothing to look forward to but victory or heaven, how can you be afraid?"
While privately noting a few flaws in this argument, Jamie had found it still good advice. Freeing the conscience eased the soul, and the comforting repetition of prayer distracted the mind from fearful imaginings and lulled it towards sleep. He gazed upward into the black vault of the sky and willed the tightness of neck and shoulders to relax into the ground's hard embrace. The stars were faint and hazy tonight, no match for the nearby glow of the English fires. His mind reached out to the men around him, resting briefly on each, one by one. The stain of sin was small weight on his conscience, compared with these. Ross, McMurdo, Kincaid, Kent, McClure. He paused to give brief thanks that his wife and the boy Fergus, at least, were safe. His mind lingered on his wife, wanting to bask in the memory of her reassuring smile, the solid, wonderful warmth of her in his arms, pressed tight against him as he had kissed her goodbye that afternoon. Despite his own weariness and the waiting presence of Lord George outside, he had wanted to tumble her onto the waiting mattress right then and take her quickly, at once, without undressing. Strange how the imminence of fighting made him so ready, always.
Even now.
But he hadn't yet finished his mental roster, and he felt his eyelids closing already as tiredness sought to pull him under. He dismissed the faint tightening of his testicles that came at thought of her, and resumed his roll call, a shepherd treacherously lulled to sleep by counting the sheep he was leading to slaughter.
"But it wouldn't be a slaughter,"
he tried to reassure himself. "Light casualties for the Jacobite side. 30 men killed. Out of 2,000, only a slim chance that some of the Lallybroch men would be among that number, surely." If she was right. He shuddered faintly under the plaid, and fought down the momentary doubt that wrenched his bowels.
If. God, if.
Still, he had trouble believing it, though he had seen her by that cursed rock, face dissolving in terror around the panic-wide gold eyes, the very outlines of her body blurring as he, panicked also, had clutched at her, pulling her back, feeling little more than the frail double bone of her forearm under his hand.
Perhaps he should have let her go, back to her own place. No, no, perhaps. He knew that he should.
But he had pulled her back, given her the choice, but kept her with him by the sheer force of his wanting her. And so she had stayed. And given him the choice, to believe her or not, to act or to run. And the choice was made now, and no power on earth could stop the dawn from coming. His heart beat heavily, pulse echoing in wrists and groin and the pit of his stomach. He sought to calm it, resuming his count, one name to each heartbeat.
"Willie MacNab, Bobby MacNab, Geordie MacNab. Thank God young Rabbi MacNab was safe, left at home. Will Fraser, Ewan Fraser, Geoffrey McClure. McClure." Had he touched on both George and Sorley?
Shifted slightly, smiling faintly, feeling for the soreness left along his ribs.
"Murto. Aye, Murto. Tough old boot. My mind is no troubled on your account, at least. William Murray, Rufus Murray, Geordie, Wallace, Simon."
And at last had closed his eyes, commended all of them to the care of the black sky above, and lost himself in the murmured words that came to him still most naturally in French.
Mon Dieu, je regrette.
I made my rounds inside the cottage, changing a blood-soaked dressing on one man's leg. The bleeding should have stopped by now, but it hadn't. Poor nutrition and brittle bones. If the bleeding hadn't stopped before cockcrow, I would have to fetch Archie Cameron or one of the farrier surgeons to amputate the leg and cauterize the stump. I hated the thought of it. Life was sufficiently hard for a man with all his limbs in good working order. Hoping for the best, I coated the new dressing with a light sprinkling of alum and sulphur. If it didn't help, it wouldn't hinder. Likely it would hurt, but that couldn't be helped. It will burn a bit, I murmured to the man as I wrapped his leg in the layers of cloth.
Dunna worry yourself, mistress, he whispered.
He smiled at me in spite of the sweat that ran down his cheeks, shiny in the light of my candle.
I'll stand it.
Good. I patted his shoulder, smoothed the hair off his brow, and gave him a drink of water.
I'll check again in an hour, if you can bear it that long. I'll stand it, he said again.
Outside once more, I thought Jamie had fallen asleep. His face rested on his folded forearms, crossed on his knees. But he looked up at the sound of my step and took my hand as I sat beside him. I heard the cannon at dawn, I said, thinking of the man inside, leg broken by a cannonball. I was afraid for you. He laughed softly.
So was I, Sassenach. So were we all.
Quiet as wisps of mist, the Highlanders advanced through the sea grass, 1 foot at a time. There was no sense of darkness lessening, but the feel of the night had changed. The wind had changed, that was it. It blew from the sea over the cold dawning land, and the faint thunder of waves on distant sand could be heard. Despite his impression of continued dark, the light was coming. He saw the man at his feet just in time. One more step and he would have been headlong across the man's curled body. Heart pounding from the shock of the near meeting, he dropped to his haunches to get a better look. A redcoat. And sleeping. Not dead or wounded. He squinted hard into the darkness around them, willing his ears to listen for the breathing of other sleeping men. Nothing but sea sounds, grass and wind sounds. The tiny swish of stealthy feet almost hidden in their muted roar. He glanced hastily back, licking lips gone dry despite the moist air. There were men close behind him. He dared not hesitate long. The next man might not be so careful where he stepped, and they could risk no outcry. He set hand to his dirk, but hesitated. War was war, but it went against the grain to slay a sleeping enemy. The man seemed to be alone, some distance from his companions. Not a sentinel, not even the slackest of guards would sleep, knowing the Highlanders to be camped on the ridge above. Perhaps a soldier had gotten up to relieve himself, thoughtfully come some distance from his fellows to do it, then, losing his direction in the dark, lain down to sleep where he was. The metal of his musket was slick from his sweating palm. He rubbed his hand on his plaid, then stood, grasped the barrel of the musket and swung the butt in a vicious arc down and around. The shock of impact jolted him to the shoulder blades. An immobile head is solid. The man's arms had flown out with the force of the impact, but beyond an explosion of breath he had made no noise and now lay sprawled on his face, limp as a clout. Palms tingling, he stooped again and groped beneath the man's jaw, looking for a pulse. He found one, and reassured, stood up. There was a muffled cry of startlement from behind, and he swung around, musket already at his shoulder, to find its barrel poking into the face of one of Keppoch's MacDonald clansmen.
Mon Dieu,
the man whispered, crossing himself, and Jamie clenched his teeth with aggravation. It was Keppoch's bloody French priest, dressed, at O'Sullivan's suggestion, in shirt and plaid like the fighting men.
The man insisted that it was his duty to bring the sacraments to the wounded and dying on the field, Jamie explained to me, hitching his stained plaid higher on his shoulder.
The night was growing colder.
O'Sullivan's idea was that if the English caught him on the battlefield in his cassock, they'd tear him to pieces. As to that, maybe so, maybe no. But he looked a right fool in a plaid, he added censoriously.
Nor had the priest's behaviour done anything to ameliorate the impression caused by his attire. Realising belatedly that his assailant was a Scot, he had sighed in relief, and then opened his mouth. Moving quickly, Jamie had clapped a hand over it before any ill-advised questions could emerge.
"What are you doing here, father?" he growled, mouth pressed to the priest's ear. "You're meant to be behind the lines."
A widening of the priest's eyes at this told Jamie the truth. The man of God, lost in the darkness, had thought he was behind the lines. And the belated realization that he was, in fact, in the vanguard of the advancing Highlanders, made him buckle slightly at the knees. Jamie glanced backward. He didn't dare send the priest back through the lines. In the misty dark, he could easily stumble into an advancing Highlander, be mistaken for an enemy, and be killed on the spot. Gripping the smaller man by the back of the neck, he pushed him to his knees.
"Lie flat, and stay that way until the firing stops," he hissed into the man's ear.
The priest nodded frantically, then suddenly saw the body of the English soldier lying on the ground a few feet away. He glanced up at Jamie in awed horror, and reached for the bottles of chrism and holy water that he wore at his belt in lieu of a dirk. Rolling his eyes in exasperation, Jamie made a series of violent motions meant to indicate that the man wasn't dead and thus in no need of the priest's services. These, failing to make their point, he bent, seized the priest's hand, and pressed the fingers on the Englishman's neck, as the simplest method of illustrating that the man wasn't, in fact, the first victim of the battle. Caught in this ludicrous position, he froze as a voice cut through the mist behind him.
"Halt," it said. "Who goes there?"
"Have you got a bit of water, Sassenach?" asked Jamie. "I'm getting a bit dry with the talking."
"Bastard," I said. "You can't stop there. What happened?"
"Water," he said, grinning. "And I'll tell you."
"All right," I said, handing him a water bottle and watching as he tilted it into his mouth. "What happened then?"
"Nothing," he said,
lowering the bottle and wiping his mouth on his sleeve.
"What did you think? I was going to answer him."
He grinned impudently at me and ducked as I aimed a slap at his ear.
"No, no," he reproved. "No way to treat a man wounded in the service of his king now, is it?"
"Wounded, are you?" I said.
"Believe me, Jamie Fraser, a mere sabre-slash is as nothing compared to what I will do to you if—" "Oh, threats too, is it? What was that poem you told me about? When pain and anguish wring the brow, a ministering angel—"
"How?" "Next time I twist it right off at the roots," I said, releasing the ear. "Get on with it. I have to go back in a minute." He rubbed the ear gingerly, but leaned back against the wall and resumed his story.
"Well, we just sat there on our haunches, the padre and I, staring at each other and listening to the sentries 6 feet away. 'What's that?' says the one. And me, thinking, 'Can I get up in time to take him with my dirk before he shoots me in the back? And what about his friend?' For I cannot expect help from the priest, unless maybe it's a last prayer over my body."
There was a long, nerve-wracking silence as the two Jacobites squatted in the grass, hands still clasped, afraid to move enough even to let go.
"Now, you're seeing things,"
came from the other sentry at last, and Jamie felt the shudder of relief run through the priest as his damp fingers slid free.
"Nothing up there but furze bushes." "Never mind, lad," the sentry said reassuringly,
and Jamie heard the clap of a hand on a shoulder and the stamp of booted feet trying to keep warm.
"There's the damn lot of them, sure, and in this dark they could be the whole bloody island army for all you can see."
Jamie thought he heard the breath of a smothered laugh from one of the furze bushes on the hillside within hearing. He glanced at the crest of the hill, where the stars were beginning to dim. less than 10 minutes to first light, he judged. At which point, Johnny Cope's troops would swiftly realize that the Highland Army was not, as they thought, an hour's march away in the opposite direction, but already face to face with their front lines. There was a noise to the left, in the direction of the sea. It was faint and indistinct, but the note of alarm was clear to battle-trained ears. Someone, he supposed, had tripped over a furze bush.
"Hey!"
The note of alarm was taken up by one of the sentries nearby.
"What's happening?"
The priest would have to take care of himself, he thought. Jamie drew the broadsword as he rose, and with one long step was within reach. The man was no more than a shape in the darkness, but distinct enough. The merciless blade smashed down with all his strength and split the man's skull where he stood.
"Highlanders!"
The shriek broke from the man's companion, and the second sentry sprang out like a rabbit flushed from a copse, bounding away into the fading dark before Jamie could free his weapon from its gory cleft. He put a foot on the fallen man's back and jerked, gritting his teeth against the unpleasant sensation of slack flesh and grating bone. Alarm was spreading up and down the English lines. He could feel as much as hear it, an agitation of men rudely wakened, groping blindly for weapons, searching in all directions for the unseen threat. Clanranald's pipers were behind to the right, but no signal as yet came for the charge. Continue the advance, then, heart pounding and left arm tingling from the death blow, belly muscles clenched and eyes straining through the waning dark, the spray of warm blood across his face going cold and sticky in the chill. "I could hear them first," he said, staring off into the night as though still searching for the English soldiers. He bent forward, hugging his knees.
"Then I could see them, too. The English, wriggling over the ground like maggots in meat, and the men behind me. George McClure came up wi' me, and Wallace and Ross on the other side, and we were walking still, one piece at a time, but faster and faster, seeing the Sassenachs breaking before us."
There was a dull boom off to the right, the firing of a single cannon. A moment later, another, and then, as though this were the signal, a wavering cry rose from the oncoming Highlanders.
"The pipes started then," he said, eyes closed. "I didn't remember my musket till I heard one fire close behind me. I'd left it in the grass next to the priest. When it's like that, you dinna see anything but the small bit that's happening round you. You hear a shout, and of a sudden you're running. Slow, for a step or two, while you free your belt. And then your plaid falls free and you're bounding with your feet splashing mud up your legs and the chill of the wet grass on your feet, and your shirt tails flying off your bare arse. The wind blows into your shirt and up your belly and out along your arms. Then the noise takes you and you're screaming, like running down a hill, yelling into the wind when you're a bairn, to see if you can lift yourself on the sound." They rode the waves of their own shrieking onto the plain, and the force of the Highland charge crashed onto the shoals of the English army, smothering them in a boiling surge of blood and terror. "They ran," he said softly. "One man stood to face me, all during the fight. Only one. The others I took from behind."
He rubbed a grimy hand over his face, and I could feel a fine tremor start somewhere deep inside him.
"I remember everything,"
he said, almost whispering.
"Every blow, every face.
The man lying on the ground in front of me who wet himself with fear. The horses screaming. All the stinks, black powder and blood and the smell of my own sweat. Everything. But it's like I was standing outside, watching myself. I wasn't really there."
He opened his eyes and looked sidelong at me. He was bent almost double, head on his knees, the shivering visible now.
"Do you know?" he asked.
"I know." While I hadn't fought with sword or knife, I had fought often enough with hands and will. getting through the chaos of death only because there is no other choice. And it did leave behind that odd feeling of detachment. The brain seemed to rise above the body, coldly judging and directing, the viscera obediently subdued until the crisis passed. It was always some time later that the shaking started. I hadn't reached that point yet. I slid the cloak from my shoulders and covered him before going back into the cottage. The dawn came, and relief with it, in the person of two village women and an army surgeon. The man with the wounded leg was pale and shaky, but the bleeding had stopped. Jamie took me by the arm and led me away, down the street of Trenent. O'Sullivan's constant difficulties with a commissary had been temporarily relieved by the captured wagons, and there was food in plenty. We ate quickly, scarcely tasting the hot porridge, aware of food only as a bodily necessity, like breathing. A feeling of nourishment began to creep through my body, freeing me to think of the next most pressing need, sleep. Wounded men were quartered in every house and cottage. The sound of body, mostly sleeping in the fields outside. While Jamie could have claimed a place in the manse with the other officers, he instead took my arm and turned me aside, heading between the cottages and up a hill into one of the scattered small groves that lay outside Trenent.
"It's a bit of a walk,"
he said apologetically, looking down at me.
"But I thought perhaps you'd rather be private."
"I would." While I had been raised under conditions that would strike most people of my time as primitive, often living in tents and mud houses on Uncle Lamb's field expeditions, still, I wasn't used to living crowded cheek by jowl with numbers of people, as was customary here. People ate, slept, and frequently copulated, crammed into tiny, stifling cottages, lit and warmed by smoky peat fires. The only thing they didn't do together was bathe. Largely because they didn't bathe. Jamie led the way under the drooping limbs of a huge horse chestnut and into a small clearing, thick with the fallen leaves of ash, alder, and sycamore. The sun was barely up, and it was still cold under the leaves, a faint edge of frost rimming some of the yellowed leaves. He scraped a rough trench in the layer of leaves with one heel, then stood at one end of the hollow, set his hand to the buckle of his belt, and smiled at me.
"It's a bit undignified to get into, but it's very easy to take off."
He jerked the belt loose, and his plaid dropped around his ankles, leaving him clad to mid-thigh in only his shirt. He usually wore the military little kilt, which buckled about the waist, with the plaid a separate strip of cloth around the shoulders. But now, his own kilt rent and stained from the battle, he had acquired one of the older belted plaids, nothing more than a long strip of cloth, tucked about the waist, and held in place with no fastening but a belt. "How do you get into it?" I asked curiously.
"Well, you lay it out on the ground like this."
He knelt, spreading the cloth so that it lined the leaf-strewn hollow.
"And then you pleat it every few inches, lie down on it, and roar."
I burst out laughing and sank to my knees, helping to smooth the thick tartan wool. "That I want to see," I told him. "Wake me up before you get dressed." He shook his head good-naturedly, and the sunlight filtering through the leaves glinted off his hair.
"Sassenach, the chances of me waking before you do are less than those of a worm in a henyard. I dinna care if another horse steps on me. I'll no be moving till tomorrow."
He lay down carefully, pushing back the leaves.
"Come, lie wi' me."
He extended an inviting hand upward.
"We'll cover ourselves with your cloak."
The leaves beneath the smooth wool made a surprisingly comfortable mattress, though at this point I would cheerfully have slept on a bed of nails. I relaxed bonelessly against him, revelling in the exquisite delight of simply lying down. The initial chill faded quickly as our bodies warmed the pocket where we lay. We were far enough from the town that the sounds of its occupation reached us only in wind-borne snatches. And I thought, with drowsy satisfaction, that it might well be tomorrow before anyone looking for Jamie found us. I had removed my petticoats and torn them up for additional bandages the night before, and there was nothing between us but the thin fabric of skirt and shirt. A hard, solid warmth stirred briefly against my stomach. "Surely not," I said, amused despite my tiredness. "Jamie, you must be half dead." He laughed tiredly, holding me close with one large, warm hand on the small of my back.
"A lot more than half, Sassenach. I'm knackered, and my cock's the only thing too stupid to know it. I canna lie wi' you without wanting you, but wanting's all I'm like to do."
I fumbled with the hem of his shirt, then pushed it up and wrapped my hand gently around him. Even warmer than the skin of his belly, his penis was silken under the touch of my stroking thumb, pulsing strongly with each beat of his heart. He made a small sound of half-painful content and rolled slowly onto his back, letting his legs sprawl loosely outward, half-covered by my cloak. The sun had reached our pile of leaves, and my shoulders relaxed under the warming touch of the light. Everything seemed slightly tinged with gold, the mingled result of early autumn and extreme fatigue. I felt languid and vaguely disembodied, watching the small stirrings of his flesh under my fingers. All the terror and the tiredness and the noise of the 2 days past ebbed slowly away, leaving us alone together. The haze of fatigue seemed to act as a magnifying glass, exaggerating tiny details and sensations. The tail of his sabre wound was visible beneath the rucked-up shirt, crusted black against the fair skin. 2 or 3 small flies buzzed low, investigating, and I waved them away. My ears rang with the silence, the breath of the trees no match for the echoes of the town. I laid my cheek against him, feeling the hard, smooth curve of his hip bone close under the skin. His skin was transparent in the crease of his groin, the branching veins blue and delicate as a child's. His hand rose slowly, floating like the leaves, and rested lightly on my head. "Claire, I need you," he whispered. "I need you so." Without the hampering petticoats, it was easy. I felt as though I were floating myself, rising without volition, drifting my skirts up the length of his body, settling over him like a cloud on a hilltop, sheltering his need. His eyes were closed, head laid back, the red gold of his hair tumbled coarsely in the leaves. But his hands rose together and settled surely on my waist, resting without weight on the curve of my hips. My eyes closed as well, and I felt the shapes of his mind as surely as I felt those of his body under me. Exhaustion blocked our every thought and memory, every sensation but the knowledge of each other.
"Not long," he whispered.
I nodded, knowing he felt what he didn't see, and rose above him, thighs powerful and sure under the stained fabric of my gown. Once, and twice, and again, and once again, and the tremor rose through him and through me, like the rising of water through the roots of a plant and into its leaves. The breath left him in a sigh, and I felt his descent into unconsciousness like the dimming of a lamp. I fell beside him, with barely time to draw the heavy folds of the cloak up over us, before the darkness filled me. And I lay weighted to the earth by the heavy warmth of his seed in my belly. We slept. Chapter 37. Holyrood, Edinburgh, October 1745. The knock on my door surprised me from an inspection of my newly replenished medical boxes. After the stunning victory at Prestonpans, Charles had led his triumphant army back to Edinburgh, to bask in adulation. While he was basking, His generals and chieftains laboured, rallying their men and procuring what equipment was to be had in preparation for whatever was coming next. Buoyed by early success, Charles talked freely of taking Stirling, then Carlisle, and then, perhaps, of advancing south even to London itself. I spent my spare time counting suture needles, hoarded willow bark, and stole every spare ounce of alcohol I could find to be brewed into disinfectant. "What is it?" I asked, opening the door. The messenger was a young boy, scarcely older than Fergus. He was trying to look grave and deferential, but couldn't suppress his natural curiosity. I saw his eyes dart around the room, resting on the large medicine chest in the corner with fascination. Clearly the rumours concerning me had spread through the palace of Holyrood.
"His Highness has asked for ye, Mistress Fraser," he answered.
Bright brown eyes scanned me closely, no doubt looking for signs of supernatural possession. He seemed slightly disappointed at my depressingly normal appearance.
"Oh, has he?" I said. "Well, all right. Where is he, then?" "In the morning drawing-room, mistress. I'm to take you."
"Oh!" The thought struck him as he turned, and he swung back before I could close the door.
"You're to bring your box of medicines, if you'd be so kind."
My escort brimmed with self-importance at his mission as he escorted me down the long hallway to the royal wing of the palace. Plainly, someone had been schooling him in the behaviour appropriate to a royal page, but an occasional exuberant skip in his step betrayed his newness to the job. What on earth did Charles want with me? I wondered. While he tolerated me on Jamie's account, the story of La Dame Blanche had plainly disconcerted him and made him uneasy. More than once I had surprised him crossing himself surreptitiously in my presence, or making the quick two-fingered horn sign against evil. The idea that he would ask me to treat him medically was unlikely in the extreme. When the heavy cross-timbered door swung open into the small morning drawing-room, it seemed still more unlikely. The prince, plainly in good health, was leaning on the painted harpsichord, picking out a hesitant tune with one finger. His delicate skin was mildly flushed, but with excitement, not fever, and his eyes were clear and attentive when he looked up at me.
"Mistress Fraser, how kind of you to attend me so shortly."
He was dressed this morning with even more lavishness than usual, bewigged and wearing a new cream-coloured silk waistcoat embroidered with flowers. "He must be excited about something," I thought. His English went to pop whenever he became agitated.
"My pleasure, Your Highness," I said demurely, dropping a brief curtsy.
He was alone, an unusual state of affairs. Could he want my medical services for himself after all? He made a quick, nervous gesture toward one of the gold damask chairs, urging me to be seated. A second chair was pulled up, facing it, but he walked up and down in front of me, too restless to sit.
"I need your help," he said abruptly.
"Hmm?"
I made a politely inquiring noise. "Gonorrhea?" I wondered, scanning him covertly. I hadn't heard of any women since Louise de la Tour, but then it only took once. He worked his lips in and out as though searching for some alternative to telling me, but finally gave it up.
"I have a capo, a chief, you understand, here. He thinks of joining my father's cause, but has still some doubt."
"A clan chieftain, you mean?"
He nodded, brow furrowed beneath the careful curls of his wig.
"Oui, madame. He is, of course, in support of my father's claims."
"Oh, of course," I murmured.
"But he is wishing to speak to you, madame, before he will commit his men to follow me."
He sounded incredulous, hearing his own words, and I realized that the flush on his cheeks came from a combination of bafflement and suppressed fury. I was more than a little baffled myself. My imagination promptly visualized a clan chieftain with some dread disease, whose adherence to the cause depended on my performing a miraculous cure.
"You're sure he wants to speak to me?" I said.
Surely my reputation hadn't gone that far. Charles inclined his head coldly in my direction.
So he says, madame.
But I don't know any clan chieftains, I said.
Bar Glengarry and Lochiel, of course. Oh, and Clan Ranald and Keppoch, of course.
But they've all committed themselves to you already. And why on earth...
Well, he is of the opinion you are knowing him, the prince interrupted, syntax becoming more mangled with his rising temper.
He clenched his hands, obviously forcing himself to speak courteously.
It is of importance, most importance, madame, that he should become convinced to join me. I request you, therefore, that you convince him.
I rubbed my nose thoughtfully, looking at him. One more point of decision. One more opportunity to make events move in the path I chose. And once more, the inability to know what best to do. He was right. It was important to convince this chieftain to commit his resources to the Jacobite cause. With the Camerons, the various MacDonalds, and the others so far committed, the Jacobite army numbered barely 2,000 men, and those the most ill-assorted lot of ragtag and draggletail that any general had ever been lumbered with. And yet, that ragged-arsed lot had taken the city of Edinburgh, routed a greatly superior English force at Preston, and showed every disposition to continue going through the countryside like a dose of salts. We had been unable to stop Charles. Perhaps, as Jamie said, the only way to avert calamity was now to do everything possible to help him. The addition of an important clan chieftain to the roster of supporters would greatly influence the odds of others joining. This might be a turning point, where the Jacobite forces could be increased to the level of a true army, actually capable of the proposed invasion of England. And if so, what in bloody hell would happen then? I sighed. No matter what I decided to do, I couldn't make any decision until I saw this mysterious person. I glanced down to make sure my gown was suitable for interviewing clan chieftains, infected or otherwise, and rose, tucking the medicine box under my arm. "I'll try, Your Highness," I said. The clenched hands relaxed, showing the bitten nails, and his frown lessened. "Ah, good," he said. He turned toward the door of the larger afternoon drawing-room. "Come, I shall take you myself." The guard at the door jumped back in surprise as Charles flung the door open and strode past him without a glance. On the far side of the long, tapestry-hung room was an enormous marble fireplace, lined with white Delft tiles, painted with Dutch country scenes in shades of blue and mulberry. A small sofa was drawn up before the fire, and a big, broad-shouldered man in Highland dress stood beside it. In a room less imposing, he would have bulked huge, legs like tree trunks in their checkered stockings beneath the kilt. As it was, in this immense room with its high gessoed ceilings, he was merely big, quite in keeping with the heroic figures of mythology that decorated the tapestries at either end of the room. I stopped dead at the sight of the enormous visitor, the shock of recognition still mingled with absolute incredulity. Charles had kept on, and now glanced back with some impatience, beckoning me to join him before the fire. I nodded to the big man. Then I walked slowly around the end of the sofa and gazed down at the man who lay upon it. He smiled faintly when he saw me, the dove-grey eyes lighting with a spark of amusement.
"Yes," he said, answering my expression. "I hadn't really expected to meet you again, either. One might almost believe we are fated."
He turned his head and lifted a hand toward his enormous body-servant.
"Angus, will you fetch a drop of brandy for Mistress Clare? I'm afraid the surprise of seeing me may have somewhat discomposed her."
That, I thought, was putting it mildly. I sank into a splay-footed chair and accepted the crystal goblet Angus Moore held out to me. Colum Mackenzie's eyes hadn't changed, neither had his voice. Both held the essence of the man who had led Clan Mackenzie for 30 years, despite the disease that had crippled him in his teens. Everything else had changed sadly for the worse, though. The black hair streaked heavily with grey, the lines of his face cut deep into skin that had fallen slack over the sharp outlines of bone. Even the broad chest was sunken, and the powerful shoulders hunched, flesh fallen away from the fragile skeleton beneath. He already held a glass half-filled with amber liquid, glowing in the firelight. He raised himself painfully to a sitting position, and lifted the cup in ironic salute.
"You're looking very well, niece." From the corner of my eye I saw Charles's mouth drop open. "You aren't," I said bluntly.
He glanced dispassionately down at the bowed and twisted legs. In 100 years' time they would call this disease after its most famous sufferer, the Toulouse-Lautrec syndrome.
"No," he said, "but then it's been 2 years since you saw me last. Mrs. Duncan estimated my survival at less than 2 years then."
I took a swallow of the brandy. One of the best.
Charles was anxious.
"I shouldn't have thought you'd put much stock in a witch's curse," I said.
A smile twitched the fine-cut lips. He had the bold beauty of his brother Dougal, ruined as it was, and when he lifted the veil of detachment from his eyes, the power of the man overshone the wreck of his body.
"Not in curses, no. I had the distinct impression that the lady was dealing in observation, however, not malediction, and I have seldom met a more acute observer than Gilles Duncan, with one exception."
He inclined his head gracefully toward me, making his meaning clear.
"Thanks," I said.
Colum glanced up at Charles, who was gaping in bewilderment at these exchanges.
"I thank you for your graciousness in permitting me to use your premises for my meeting with Mrs. Fraser, Your Highness," he said, with a slight bow.
The words were sufficiently civil, but the tone made it an obvious dismissal. Charles, who was by no means used to being dismissed, flushed hotly and opened his mouth. Then, recalling himself, he snapped it shut, bowed shortly, and turned on his heel.
"We won't need the guard either," I called after him.
His shoulders hunched, and the back of his neck grew red beneath the tail of his wig. But he gestured abruptly, and the guard at the door, with an astonished glance at me, followed him out. Colum cast a brief glance of disapproval at the door, then returned his attention to me.
"I asked to see you because I owe you an apology," he said, without preamble.
I leaned back in my chair, goblet resting nonchalantly on my stomach.
"Oh, an apology," I said, with as much sarcasm as could be mustered on short notice. "For trying to have me burnt for witchcraft, I suppose you mean."
I flipped a hand in gracious dismissal. "Pray think nothing of it." I glared at him.
"Apology?"
He smiled, not disconcerted in the slightest.
"I suppose it seems a trifle inadequate," he began.
"Inadequate?
For having me arrested and thrown into a thieves' hole for 3 days without decent food or water. For having me stripped half-naked and whipped before every person in Cranesmuir. For leaving me a hair's breadth away from a barrel of pitch and a bundle of faggots." I stopped and took a deep breath.
"Now that you mention it," I said, a little more calmly,
"inadequate
is precisely what I'd call it."
The smile had vanished.
"I beg your pardon for my apparent levity," he said softly. "I had no intent to mock you."
I looked at him, but could see no lingering gleam of amusement in the black-lashed eyes.
"No,"
I said, with another deep breath.
"I don't suppose you did. I suppose you're going to say that you had no intent to have me arrested for witchcraft, either."
The grey eyes sharpened.
"You knew that?"
"Gilly said so.
While we were in the thieves' hole. She said it was her you meant to dispose of. I was an accident."
"You were."
He looked suddenly very tired.
"Had you been in the castle, I could have protected you. What in the name of God led you to go down to the village?"
"I was told that Gilly Duncan was ill and asking for me. I replied shortly.
Ah, he said softly. You were told. By whom, and I may ask?
Lyra.
Even now I couldn't repress a brief spurt of rage at the girl's name. Out of thwarted jealousy over my having married Jamie, she had deliberately tried to have me killed. Considerable depths of malice for a 16-year-old girl. And even now, mingled with the rage, was that tiny spark of grim satisfaction. He's mine, I thought, almost subconsciously. Mine. You'll never take him from me. Never.
Ah,
Colum said again, staring thoughtfully at my flushed countenance.
I thought perhaps that was the way of it. Tell me, he continued, raising one dark brow, if a mere apology strikes you as inadequate, will you have vengeance instead?
Vengeance? I must have looked startled at the idea, for he smiled faintly, though without humour.
Aye. The lass was wed 6 months ago to Hugh Mackenzie of Muldoor, one of my taxmen. He'll do with her as I say, and you want her punished. What will you have me do?
I blinked, taken aback by his offer. He appeared in no hurry for an answer. He sat quietly, sipping the fresh glass of brandy that Angus Moore poured for him. He wasn't staring at me, but I got up and moved away toward the windows, wanting to be alone for a moment. The walls here were 5 feet thick. By leaning forward into the deep window embrasure, I could assure myself of privacy. The bright sun illuminated the fine blonde hairs on my forearms as I rested them on the sill. It made me think of the thieves' hole, that damp, reeking pit, and the single bar of sunlight that had shone through an opening above, making the dark hole below seem that much more like a grave by contrast. I had spent my first day there in cold and dirt, full of stunned disbelief. The second, in shivering misery and growing fear, as I discovered the full extent of Gillis Duncan's treachery and Colum's measures against it. And on the third day, they had taken me to trial. And I had stood, filled with shame and terror, under the clouds of a lowering autumn sky, feeling the jaws of Colum's trap close around me. Sprung by a word from the girl, Lyra.
Lyra. Fair-skinned and blue-eyed, with a round, pretty face. But nothing much to distinguish her from the other girls at Lyoch.
I had thought about her, in the pit with Gillis Duncan. I had had time to think of a lot of things. But furious and terrified as I had been, furious as I remained, I couldn't, either then or now, bring myself to see her as intrinsically evil.
She was only 16, for God's sake. Old enough to marry, said a sardonic voice behind me, and I realized that I had spoken aloud.
Yes, she wanted Jamie, I said, turning around. Colum was still sitting on the sofa, stumpy legs covered with a rug. Angus Moore stood silent behind him, heavy-lidded eyes fixed on his master. Perhaps she thought she loved him. Men were drilling in the courtyard amid shouts and clashing of arms. The sun glanced off the metal of swords and muskets, the brass studding of targes, and off the red gold of Jamie's hair flying in the breeze as he wiped a hand across his face, flushed and sweating from the exercise, laughing at one of Murtaugh's deadpan remarks. I had perhaps done Lyra an injustice, after all, in assuming her feelings to be less than my own. Whether she had acted from immature spite or from a true passion, I could never know. In either case, she had failed. I had survived, and Jamie was mine. As I watched, he wrapped up his kilt and casually scratched his bottom, the sunlight catching the reddish-gold fuzz that softened the iron-hard curve of his thigh. I smiled and went back to my seat near Colum. "I'll take the apology," I said. He nodded, grey eyes thoughtful.
"You've a belief in mercy, then, mistress?"
"More in justice," I said. "Speaking of which, I don't imagine you travelled all the way from Leoch to Edinburgh merely to apologise to me.
It must have been a hellish journey.
Aye, it was.
The huge silent bulk of Angus Moore shifted an inch or two.